already, I think back in early September, I was trying to tell people that, hey, look at this, this is going to create a lot of revenue and profits. And people are like, yeah, I don't know, not really interested.
Does it have a hat?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's what's missing.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Bell Curve. Before we jump in, quick disclaimer, the views expressed by my co-host today are their personal views and they do not represent the views of any organization with which the co-hosts are associated with. Nothing in the episode is construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. You know the deal. Now, let's jump into the episode.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to another roundup of On the Margin. Today, I'm joined by two of Blockwork's star analyst class. We got Westy and Brick on the pod. Fellas, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
So we're gonna spend most of this podcast actually talking about Maker. We've got a new dashboard coming out, and I feel like people have been pretty inundated with Bitcoin ETF content for the majority of the week. But just before we jump in, you know, we're recording this on Thursday morning, so we're a couple of hours into trading. I think we've got over 2 billion clocked in volume for the combined spot ETFs, which is an impressive start. I'm looking at the latest tweet from Eric Balkunas, who is essentially the guru on this topic, along with James Seyfert. And, you know, safe to say we're going to be breaking some records today. So let me hold your guys' feet to the fire and get a little prediction for the listeners here. Where do you guys think we end trading today? Any predictions around that? Or is this going to end up being a sell the news event? Or do you guys have any sort of thoughts early on the ETF based on today's info?
I mean, I just check the price and apparently people are already selling. So I don't know what's going to happen there. But I don't know, long term, my opinion is that it doesn't matter what happens today. Like, just buy the coins and hold them. That's the strategy to like win at this game.
Yeah, I'm expecting a pretty volatile day overall. But yeah, no numbers on specific inflows because that's really out of my range in particular to try and guess that. But yeah, a lot of volatility. And like Brick said, this is obviously a huge catalyst overall. And whether it's a sell the news, buy the news, doesn't matter. I think 6 months from now, we'll see a lot better prices.
Yeah, I'm in that boat too. Fool's errand to guess. All right, guys, let's start talking about Maker. And I know, Westy, you're going to share your screen and walk us through some of this dashboard that we created at Blockworks Research. But for folks who might not be following, and just to give you guys credit, I feel like I would have no idea what the Maker endgame is if it wasn't for you guys. It's definitely been difficult to follow, but it's been a big year for Maker, and I think there's a lot of reasons to be bullish on the protocol. And I think we're going to walk through some of those facts. But for folks that haven't been following Maker as closely, can you guys just give us a sort of an overview of the current state of the protocol, as well as some of the proposed changes, like the redenomination of Maker, and maybe just summarize the end game for us?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, last year definitely was pretty eventful for Maker. What basically happened was Runeck, so the founder of the protocol, introduced this five-faced plan called Endgame to change the protocol in pretty significant ways. And the main point of the whole plan is to kind of diversify or decentralize the governance structure. So one of the main points is the introduction of sub-DAOs, and then kind of moving the protocol forward to what is being called the end state, where it can kind of take care of itself, I guess would be the best explanation. And being totally decentralized when you look at governance. And there was a lot of friction within like the large players in governance when this endgame proposal came out. Because there were basically two camps, those who were in favor of this endgame plan, and then another camp that basically wanted to implement more of a like corporate structure, where you'd have kind of a board and not the CEO, but you get what I was saying. And when the end game plan was pushed through, a lot of like core contributors and governance people left, which kind of left the protocol scrambling, which is probably one of the reasons why Endgame still hasn't started. And to explain what it is, it's a five-phased plan, and I'll go through the like main points for each plan or each phase. So the first phase is basically like a rebranding of Maker, which is trying to unify the whole brand, and the new native governance token as well as a stable coin will be introduced. The old tokens will still be functional, but the idea is that you can kind of switch between these two, or the old versions and the new versions. And one thing that has recently caught a lot of people's eyes is the fact that Maker or the MKR token will be redominated 1 token to 24,000 tokens of the new governance token if the proposed change goes through, which should happen at the end of January if it happens. But anyway, so then people are talking about, oh, the token price is going to go down, even though like nothing happens to the market cap or FDV, but there's just like units bias there in play. But yeah, that's basic phase one. Then for phase two, we will see like the proper introduction of sub-DAOs, which are basically kind of DAOs that work on some specific tasks, while Maker Core DAO takes care of kind of like internal governance things, and while these sub-DAOs focus more on a product or some specific like trying to facilitate governance in a better way. And phase two will also introduce sub-DAO token mining or like farming. So each sub-DAO will have their own native token, and through that, Maker is trying to create these sub-communities basically who are more specialized in certain things that the sub-DAO will be doing. And a good example of a sub-DAO that's already live is Spark DAO, which is basically the DAO for Spark Protocol, which is a money market on Ethereum and Gnosis chain. And yeah, Spark DAO will be responsible for developing products that are complementary to Spark Protocol, as well as then, of course, taking care of Spark Protocol. Then phase three is a bit of an interesting one, which is supposed to introduce AI into the protocol. So like help, or because governance is at the moment pretty, not convoluted, but it's super hard to follow what's happening in the forums because there's so many proposals going on and the protocol is so large. So Maker is trying to like introduce AI tools to help with the process.
There's also the Maker chain as well, creating their own chain, which obviously caused a lot of backlash when they talked about using Solana potentially as a Maker chain. And that'll be sort of like the central governance hub of Maker going forward. I'm not sure if that's phase four or phase five, but that'll be included as well.
That would be phase five when basically the protocol is moving into like its end game state, and the idea of the new chain would be to have like some of the backend stuff live on the chain. So the idea is that if something super bad happens to the protocol, you could fork the chain and through that like keep the protocol alive, because at the moment if something kind of terrible happens, to put it shortly, like the protocol which will kind of shut down, or there will be an emergency shutdown, which in short like gives out all of the collateral within the protocol, and then the protocol kind of is just destroyed after that. And yeah, for phase four, it was like governance participation incentives. So there are like several different ways in which Maker is trying to then get people to participate more in this like sub-DAO governance, and that's going to be happening through different like token farming incentives. And that's basically, yeah, the end game.
That was phase four, by the way. It's just governance incentives, incentivizing people to participate in governance. And then phase five was new chain. And for folks who might have been following, that's when Rune stirred the pot a little bit by proposing an SVM fork as kind of the basis for new chain. So let me ask you guys this before we get into some of the details of Maker and how it's performing today. And I want to talk to you guys about the RWA narrative as well. One of the things, if you listen to Rune talk about this, it feels like there's a driving underlying philosophy that's informing this. And I would say, you know, Maker or Rune is one of the OGs in crypto. And, you know, a lot of the people that got in, especially, you know, like pre to 2013 timeframe, had sort of a strong ideological take on the space. And like to summarize, I feel the way he talks about or like human organization is that it should be very, I guess, robust in the sense that people are basically going to do the most self-interested kind of net negative thing, and we should be designing our organizations to withstand humanity, basically. Whereas if you look at a guy like, there's a famous sort of organizational theorist, Coase, and his theory of the firm. The whole point of a firm is to actually reduce transaction costs through trust, right? And I guess if I had to do a high-level summary of what Rune's endgame is to basically go in the exact opposite direction, not have trust really in between any of these disparate parts of the Maker protocol, and actually segment and compartmentalize all of the different functions. One of the things that I've never really understood about the sub-DAO model, and maybe you guys know more than I do, is how are you supposed to underwrite if each one of these sub-DAOs has its own token? How do you underwrite that? Because if I were to just look at Blockworks and carve it up into different parts, like you could kind of start to create a P&L for some of our, like maybe research you could do that for, or conferences, but then you have huge parts of our business with high headcounts that aren't revenue generating but are extremely crucial to the business. And how do you underwrite a marketing function or a finance function? I'm just a little bit confused about how organization, like parts of the protocol like that, are going to have tokens associated with it. Do you guys have a sense?
Yeah, I mean, I guess this comes back to the question, is a token valuable if it doesn't accrue cash flow? Like, in my opinion, it can be, because, for example, it gives you access to something that you otherwise wouldn't have, and you could argue that, okay, some of these sub-DAOs could have like great vibes or whatever. I guess that's kind of what another sub-DAO called Sakura DAO is going for, which is more of like for newer crypto people to come in and learn about the space and do things like that. But I get what you're saying, because on the one hand, some of the sub-DAOs are supposed to be revenue generating and like function as businesses. Meanwhile, other ones are more governance focused and supposed to be, I guess, more friendly towards, I don't know, less business-like and more of just like, welcome to the sub-DAO, you can do whatever you want and like find some friends or whatever. I don't know if that's a great way to put it, but I definitely get that it's a weird structure in that sense. And there has been a lot of talk about like, how could this ever work? Because like, will you ever have enough like professionalization between these sub-DAOs? Does it spread out too much? And will people care enough for some of the sub-DAOs versus some of the other sub-DAOs? And then if one sub-DAO is doing really well, does that mean that everybody just flocks into that one and then everything else gets forgotten about?
I also think this comes from, like you said, the philosophy of creating the end game, where he's trying to create almost like a more robust maker as a whole, but allowing each individual sub DAO to experiment and find their own like voice or vision. And within that, like each token is also going to have its own vision where, you know, maybe it's revenue generating, maybe it's just a community token to represent your like access to a certain community. Maybe it's just governance. And with that, you know, governance does have some value of being able to vote on the protocol. So it's going to allow for a lot of experimentation. And it's going to be cool to see, you know, different things play out. Like Brick said, if one sub DAO starts doing extremely well versus others, do we start to see consolidation? I think it's going to allow for experimentation, which is a good thing overall for the robustness of Maker, but it's going to cause a lot of turmoil in the mean term.
Like one thing that I've sort of found myself thinking is, what if you took existing conglomerates and you superimposed this structure and you assumed different business lines had a separate stock? Like if you looked at Amazon as a business and you had the legacy business that had the Amazon token, so their sort of shipping and online retail business, but then you also had AWS and AWS had its own token. Pro, con? I'm actually not 100% sure. You could make, and people have made the argument that if AWS were to go, you know, were to get carved out and go public as a separate company, it would be worth more than Amazon. So I don't know how this is all going to work. It is an interesting experiment. And you know, the other thing that it reminds me of is, do you guys see Oppenheimer, the movie?
Yeah.
I don't know. I always, whenever I see a movie like that, I go just nerd out on Wikipedia and read about, like, I went pretty deep on the Manhattan Project and that challenge that they were alluding to of compartmentalization. You know, the Groves figure in the film who wanted all the scientists not to talk to one another. The Oppenheimer and his group of scientists at the time was opposed to that, but that's become doctrine, like as an organizational philosophy inside the U.S. to segment out different groups. And there are just pros and cons to that. And I feel like actually Rune is pretty deep on these different organizational schools of thought and is designing, has this funny mix of government design, like public policy, government sort of org structure, and traditional company thinking, which is, I guess we'll have to see how that one plays out.
Yeah, but I mean, that's pretty cool though, because I guess only in crypto could you do something like this.
Yeah.
And it's great to have some experimentation, so can't really complain about that.
With you, Brick. All right, Westy, can I pick on you here to walk us through? So this is sort of where Maker's headed, but you can also learn a lot by digging into the data that exists today. So can you walk us through some of the highlights of the dashboard that we've just created in BlockWorks Research?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to try and share my screen here. So I guess in terms of highlights, there are a few different highlights I definitely saw. And first would be this first chart here, which is annualized revenue. So to be clear, the last, I'd say, month and a half of data is currently estimations when it comes to RWAs, given that there's a lot of delay in the reporting of data, which can be, you know, over a month. And so if you hover over this data, looking at November of 2023, which was actual historical reported data, we saw over $300 million in annualized revenue, which for a crypto protocol is really incredible. It's numbers you really don't see. This is largely driven by, you know, RWA stability fees, which is majority T-bills or T-bill ETFs, as well as individual loans as well. And then a large chunk is coming from crypto interest revenue, which has been rising over the past few months as well. And then if you look at the price to sales and price to earnings ratio, because of these super high revenues and high net income, you see a price to sales ratio of 5.3x, which, you know, in crypto is easily one of the lowest you'll see, showing a lot of value. I mean, there's a lot of question marks as to, you know, why is it priced this low or valued this low? And I think there is something to say of, you know, RWAs and their potential growth opportunity, because there's an expectation that rates might lower in 2024 or likely to lower, as well as If you look at, I think there's another chart within the Dai metrics tab that looks at the PSM value, or sorry, it's, I think it's financials. No, it's right there. Yeah. The PSM value, you can see over time as they've been investing in more RWAs, the value of the PSM has dropped. But if you look at specifically within November, December, there have been large drops where the PSM has been as low as a couple hundred million. And as a result, they have asked Coinbase Custody to return some USDC that was originally given to them as part of a marketing strategy. It was instead given back to the PSM because they're worried about the collateralization. And because of the low PSM, you're going to see less investment into RWAs in the future. And if this number drops further, you're going to see some winding down of RWA vaults. And so I think there's concerns around the future growth of RWAs, as well as the fact that it's entirely off-chain and you're trusting third parties to keep track and to generate these returns. There are a couple specific loans. Two of the RWA vaults have a certain percentage of their loans in default and are currently trying to get recourse on those. And so there's a lot of question marks. And so I think the market's sort of pricing in lower growth in these RWAs, as well as the fact that they're off-chain and less reliable. So I think that's definitely point number one.
So let me return. Go back.
Yeah, maybe to give some background there for those that aren't that familiar with Maker. Basically, how Maker deploys capital into these RWAs is that they take some USDC from the peg stability module, give it to the kind of vault manager, who then redeems the USDC and invests into these off-chain assets. And that's why Westy was saying that when the PSM or the USDC in the PSM drops, it kind of limits Maker's ability to invest in, for example, T-bills. So it makes sense that the USDC in the PSM has historically been dropping because, like, Maker has invested a lot of capital into that space. But now we're coming to a point where basically, I guess there's not enough demand for DAI such that USDC in the PSM gets filled, which then limits Maker's ability to invest into these off-chain assets. But then a lot of people, as counter-argument to that, are saying that, okay, now because the bull market is kind of starting to present itself, if this revenue start dropping from T-bills and RWAs, for example, because the interest rates are expected to go down this year. Yeah, a lot of people are saying that that will be compensated through crypto loans, because basically what you're doing when you're taking out DAI from the protocol is like you're taking on leverage. And the theory is that, and what is usually seen in a bull market, is that people want more leverage. So then that would bring like some non-cyclicality to the protocol's revenue, because usually in a bull market, rates go down, but then leverage goes up, and then it works the other way around in a bear market, where then these two components are pretty like complementary. And then over the time, it's also assume that like the protocol can grow, which means that then the USDC in the PSM grows, and then again Maker is able to invest more into these T-bills and other RWAs.
Yeah, one of that, you know, you sort of anticipated one of my observation questions, I guess, which is, you know, if you're following along via video here, either on Spotify or YouTube, you can see where Maker's revenue has spiked in the past. So that was around there was a spike in May of 2021, and then again in January of 2022. And the revenue mix was extremely different back then. So the primary driver during those periods of time were crypto interest revenue and liquidations. And, you know, to your point, Brick, liquidations revenue probably kicks in when there's extreme volatility in the market. So it looks at first glance here as if Maker might have built itself something that looks like there are a couple of different complementary and actually sort of balancing revenue streams that could maybe what's its face protect Maker against some of the cyclicality that all crypto businesses face. Is that a fair assessment, or what would you guys think about that?
Yeah, I'd definitely say it's a fair assessment. So if you click on the monthly time frame and scroll down a little bit, I have it split out by vault, basically. So if you scroll down below, yeah, right there, you can see that since July, you know, as prices, since we heard about the BlackRock ETF application, prices have obviously bottomed and started rising. And as a result, we saw the demand for leverage come back. And so a lot of revenue generated by crypto-backed vaults have started to increase. And I think that's going to continue as we see prices rise throughout 2024. And so I think it's a pretty fair assessment to say that it's pretty countercyclical to the revenues generated by RWAs.
But also one thing that should be noted is that maybe it helps to think about Maker as a bank. Nothing comes free in that world, where what Maker is basically doing when they're buying RWAs is changing their collateral type for that's backing DAI. So what's happening is you're taking something super liquid, that being USDC, and then swapping that for example, short-term T-bills, which still are liquid in a sense, but if there ever will be a like huge black swan event or whatever, it would take some time for like the vault managers to sell the T-bills and basically push back USDC on chain. And if you remember, at the beginning of last year, we had this USDC depegging event, which also led to DAI kind of, or not kind of, but yeah, depegging. And back then, people were talking about like completely getting rid of the USDC PSN. And maybe it's worth mentioning that, like, for those that don't know, the USDC PSN basically lets you swap DAI and USDC one-to-one, no matter what the prices are at wherever. Maker decided to maintain the USDC PSN, although some people were saying it's a liability to be kind of attached to the token. And the reason is that in events of like high volatility, you want people to have a liquid market to change between these two tokens, such that like you can keep arbitraging between the two rates, and that stabilizes DAI a lot. So summa summarum, Maker is kind of taking on more liquidity risk when they're investing into these T-bills and RWAs. And yeah, that's a important point to make, and I think a lot of people forego that when they think about the protocol.
Yeah, I really like that analogy of Maker as a bank. We've actually talked about that on the show a couple of times, and sort of shown the similarity from a balance sheet standpoint of even something like a central bank to a bank like JP Morgan to Maker, even to, you know, down to the level of liquid staking protocols or stablecoins themselves. There's managing assets and liabilities, and banks at their heart are net interest margin businesses. And just like a bank might have a portfolio of extremely liquid securities like treasuries, you might have slightly higher interest earning, but higher liquidity risk sort of portfolio of loans, for instance, to large or small businesses. And so maybe the analogy is very similar here. But also what banks typically have are other lines of revenue which counterbalance the cyclicality of their lending business. So we saw during COVID, trading profits from banks largely propped up, you know, falling lending rates and like the IPO market that went dead for a little bit. So I really like the analogy here. What do you think? Can you talk? I mean, Brick, you were just talking about it a little bit with the PSM, but this was a pretty interesting chart for me to look at. You guys live in this data much more so than me, but just the amount of liquidity that exists in the PSM is down an enormous amount from the highs, which was, you know, back in early 2022 at 5.6 billion. You know, it's down 90% today. So, I mean, is there ever a point you think from a risk management perspective where the liquidity risk that Maker is taking on with their RWA portfolio is something to be concerned about? Is it not? I mean, how would you as an investor sort of assess that?
Yeah, I mean, at least right now, I think it's quite important that there is an avenue on chain where it's easy to like arbitrage DAI back to its peg. And especially because like it requires quite a lot of liquidity if a black swan event ever happens. Like, it might feel weird for somebody to see these large pools with a lot of liquidity and like nobody's trading the assets that much, but then if something really, really bad happens, it's important that the price can't of these stable coins like can't have these large or huge swings during these kinds of events. But yeah, I'd say right now Maker is kind of pushing the PSM liquidity to its minimum, or for the USD C vault. And it's also clear that like the main kind of decision makers have or are taking this into account. And if the amount of USDC in this PSM vault and then into other Uniswap pools drops below 300 million in total, then Maker withdraws USDC from the Coinbase custody RWA vault to like prop up the liquidity, and that strengthens the peg. But as I think Vesti was alluding to earlier, was that, and this comes back to the liquidity risk point, that once the Coinbase custody vault is completely drawn out of, and it makes sense that they start there because that's their most liquid kind of yield earning collateral, then you have to go to the next most liquid assets, which are T-bills. So if that were to happen, then kind of starts spiraling where then revenue starts dropping, you need to sell more and more, and maybe the market becomes more worried, and that might, or that would be like kind of the worst case scenario where Maker has to begin defending liquidity of DAI, if that makes sense. And yeah, I think right now is a moment where we're kind of seeing the minimum amount of USDC in the PSM such that it works, because in recent months, there has been a lot of volatility in the PSM. Like, some have speculated that it's kind of being attacked by somebody who's trying to like force Maker into liquidating their yield earning collateral. And that's why there's been a lot of withdrawals from the Coinbase custody vault.
All right, so maybe something to keep an eye on. Walk me through, guys. So we talked a little bit about the potential for DAI supply picking up, and just the main driver for that being like leverage, right? Like, primarily when I think of MakerDAO, I know they have a large RWA portfolio, but really the way that I think about it is people depositing crypto collateral, primarily ETH, and then leveraging up, and that's what they're using DAI for. So you can kind of look at the amount of outstanding DAI as demand for that leverage. But tell me if I'm wrong about that. Now, a huge part of that as well, and the incentive complex that underlies that, is this thing called the DSR, the DAI savings rate. So you guys walk us through, because there's a pretty big change in the DSR that happened within the last 3 months or so. And then can you just walk us through the role that the DAI savings rate plays in the amount of circulating DAI?
Yeah, definitely. So as those who are watching this video can see, the amount of circulating DAI had been decreasing for a while in 2023. And at one point it was decided that, so basically what affects Maker's ability to pay out interest on this DSR, which I'll explain soon, is how much profits it's making, or it's like completely attached to that. And then because Maker started investing more of the DAI collateral into these yield generating assets, of course revenue goes up and profits go up, which allows the protocol to increase the DSR, which is the DAI savings rate. So Maker allows DAI holders to deposit DAI into this DSR vault, which pays out a governance decided or a yield decided by the governance. And because revenues were higher and profits were higher, it was decided that the DSR would be increased. And it was first increased from, it had been close to zero for a long time. Then it was increased 1%. That kind of didn't help either. Then it was increased to around 3%, I think. And that didn't really like induce demand. And at that point, it was decided that this enhanced DSR would be introduced, which in short, like pumped up the interest rate to 8%, which then you can see in this chart that the amount of DAI deposited into the DSR like kind of explodes. And that's a good example of like showing how the DSR can be used to induce demand for DAI. But I think it should be noted that this mechanism mostly only works or works better in a bear market when there aren't that many opportunities to deploy capital, which is when people, as I said earlier, like minimize leverage and just look for like safe returns. And that's why this has been pretty effective now. And then I think going forward, what will like affect the market or the amount of DAI supply is like basically how much demand there is for leverage. And then, of course, how the market sees DAI itself. So how safe does it see the asset and like how liquid does it see the asset?
Yeah, Brick definitely gave a good overview. If you want to scroll down just a little bit on that dashboard, we actually have what the DAI savings rate has been over time. So you can see the slight increases up to 8% at its peak, and now it's at a terminal 5%. And you can see the deposits went absolutely nuts when they did increase to 8%. I think it increased by $1 billion in under a month in deposits. And since then, as the market started to rise again, like Brick said, people are sort of chasing what they think is higher potential returns in the market and withdrawing their DAI. So, but there's still over $1.4 billion of DAI in the DAI savings rate contracts.
Yeah. All right, guys, anything that we might not have covered so far, either critical points for investors to understand about Maker moving forward? I don't even know what we're going to end up calling it. The branding change is going to throw everyone for a loop, I think myself included, or parts of the dashboards that we haven't covered yet.
Yeah, I think the only other thing to click on would be Spark Protocol, which Brick mentioned in the sub-DAO section earlier. But if you were to scroll up, we have a whole tab looking at Spark Protocol. And it's seen immense growth since it launched in, I think it was May of last year. So they have over now $3 billion supplied in assets and over $1 billion borrowed. And that's insane growth. They're actually number 12 in terms of TVL of all protocols. And they just launched last year. And so this is incredible growth, and I think is one to keep an eye on. Right now they're doing pre-farming. So anyone who is supplying volatile collateral and borrowing against it within Spark is going to be given a portion of, I believe it's 30 million Spark tokens, which is roughly 2% after 4 years of sub-DAO farming, in terms of like the percentage of total supply. A small portion of supply is being given now, and then eventually they're going to start the sub-DAO farming. So you're able to use the new stablecoin and new governance token to farm it.
Nice. Yeah, shout out to Sam McPherson and co for just doing an amazing job on Spark Protocol. It's been, I think, one of the best year ones for a new protocol that I've certainly seen. So huge shout out and something to take advantage of. Yeah, guys, I mean, if for those of you who've been following along on video, you've seen it, but you know, those super, we'll link in the bottom of the show notes where you can go check this out. If you're not a Blockworks Research subscriber, I think we can do what we can to hook you up with a trial, but you know, we've got very comprehensive financials dashboard built out, and then deep dives on DAI, real world assets, and then Spark Protocol. So shout out to Brick and Westy and Dan as well for putting this together. Really cool. And I guess just in conclusion, zooming outside of the metrics, how are we feeling about Maker as a protocol going forward into 2024?
For me, I've been looking at this or the protocol for quite a while, and already I think back in early September I was trying to tell people that, hey, look at this is going to create a lot of revenue and profits, and people are like, yeah, I don't know, not really interested.
Does it have a hat?
yeah, maybe that's what's missing. But like, then maybe a week ago or something, a little narrative on at least crypto Twitter started, where like people started to talk about the redomination of Maker and like the revenue potential and all of this stuff, which was pretty cool to see. But I guess it didn't really sustain for that long. But I have a feeling that some of these subDAO tokens could do really well in the coming like year, and maybe especially when it comes to Spark, because like if it continues growing like this, it's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, the bet on fundamentals is clear, but I also think a lot of the intangibles, like the subDAO farming, the fact that Maker is going to be 24,000% cheaper in the future, like Unibuys is definitely a real thing. So a lot of the intangibles as well in 2024, I think you set it up to have a good year.
Yeah, but also maybe to mention that governance is still kind of a mess. Like not a lot of people know what's going on. It's kind of concentrated between those that are like super knowledgeable about the protocol. And also, yeah, endgame is a big question mark still. So maybe keep that in mind if you're trying to look at this.
It's a good flag. Hard to underwrite the complexity, but we'll see. I think you guys said it well. It's, you know, only in crypto can you run these types of extremely bold experiments. And, you know, the boomer part of my brain looks at this and is like, this seems like there's a lot of moving parts. But I also, you know, I want to root for people that are taking big swings. And that's definitely what Maker's doing. So props to the entire team over there. All right, I want to move away from Maker for a second here and talk about something that became a big debate on Twitter again this week, because Vitalik talked about potentially increasing the target gas limit on Ethereum main chain. And this has been, I guess, gas fees and transaction fees in general has been a topic that's polarized people since time immemorial in crypto, when people were talking about this in Bitcoin, and then people started talking about it within the context of Ethereum and fees being extremely high on main chain. And there's sort of one camp that says, actually, that makes the protocol unusable. Multicoin calls this anti-network effects. And then there's another group of people that says, look, honestly, history has proven out that people are willing to pay the higher fees, and generally high fees are a source of high demand. I think this has come under increasing pressure as Solana has had an extremely successful year and comeback, and it's just reignited this debate about fees. And to editorialize a little bit and put my personal take, I think put some healthy pressure on Ethereum, I would say. And, you know, even within the Ethereum camp, there's kind of two different perspectives, which is that, you know, ETH, it doesn't really matter. The entire end game for Ethereum is to move users onto layer twos. So it doesn't matter the gas fees on layer two or on ETH main chain, and we're going to get upgrades. So Dankun in the near future, I believe that's slated for April, and then full Dank sharding after that at some point, that's going to make it trivially inexpensive for users to transact and basically execution on the network. But then there's another group of people that say, okay, but, you know, 4844 is not necessarily going to increase bandwidth to the degree. There's not enough bandwidth there for all of these different rollups, and fees are still going to be expensive. And, you know, aside from that, why wouldn't we? There's a lot of slack actually on ETH main chain to raise gas fees. And so Vitalik posted something this week, and I'll turn it over to you guys to get your perspectives here. But the quote that he posted was, honestly, I think doing a modest gas limit increase even today is reasonable. The gas limit has not been increased for nearly 3 years, which is the longest time ever in protocol's history. That 2x bump in the chart in late 2021 is a fake in that it reflects the EIP-1559 transition, which increased the limit by 2x, but actually only increased average usage by 9%. So basically splitting the post-2021 gains from Moore's Law 50-50 increase between increased capacity and increased ease of syncing and verification would imply an increase to 40 million or so. So what do you guys think in general about, you know, aside from Vitalik's comment about the idea of making it more inexpensive for users to transact on ETH main chain? Is that a useful or worthwhile thing to do? Or is that just going to be kind of the ultrasound money base layer and then people are going to move to L2, so it doesn't really matter?
Yeah, when I first saw this, I was super confused because to me, like a lot of the talking points in the Ethereum roadmap that has been talked about for the past few years is really focused on, okay, the roll-up scaling roadmap. All users are going to move to L2s. The L1 is just going to host basically roll-up data. And another one would be, you know, client diversity. You want to make the L1 as robust as possible. And to me, this is pretty antithetical to both of those things. And John Charbonneau had a good tweet where he said Ethereum's kind of in this middle ground of, yeah, we want all users to end up on rollups, and that's where they transact. But we also want the L1 to be performant and people to use that too. And they kind of have to pick one or the other. And to me, raising the gas limit doesn't make much sense because it's going to lower client diversity at the execution layer. Right now, I think like over 85% of clients are using Geth, and the second client, Besu, has had a lot of issues in the recent past. And someone actually commented on that thread under Vitalik and put the specs, basically the potential block times of performance for the different execution clients, and Besu was way less performant than Geth. And so when you increase the gas limit, like, you're going to see a lot of people just switch from the minority client to the majority. And so you're pushing client diversity to be weaker with this move. And so as a result, I just think it's kind of a weird move given that we want to push users to the L2. So if it were me, I'd be against the gas limit. I'd say as an L1, you want to create it to be as robust as possible. You don't care necessarily about the fees to transact because all users are going on the L2 anyway. So yeah, that's my overall view.
Yeah, to me, this kind of feels like that, like, now with Solana having taken a lot of mind share, maybe some people are starting to wonder that, are we gonna lose liquidity, or are we gonna lose users? And now we quickly have to come up with some quick fix solution to, I don't know, maybe turn the narrative around or get back to at the front of people's minds. And I think Vesti summarized it really well that you want to kind of focus on your strengths instead of trying to hit every box here. And I think Ethereum's strengths going forward will be on the L2 level, and it just feels weird that they're going to, or that you would make changes like this on the L1 level.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I generally agree with the two of you, but I think one thing that, on the other hand, Ethereum has always been extremely conservative around their gas policy because they're very worried about stake growth, and there's a lot more capacity on the network than they're actually basically allowing for in the current state. So if you could get kind of a low hanging fruit, easy win here, why wouldn't you? I guess would be my question. Like, the thing that I feel like Solana has really nailed, and I never really, I don't hear as much from the Ethereum camp, but Vitalik just alluded to it here, is, you know, Moore's Law is a thing. It does exist. And actually things like bandwidth are improving as well, slowly over time. Like, people have better access to internet, and the assumptions that, you know, Ethereum, the protocol, has are like very, very conservative. So I don't know. It's kind of like, I get it. You have to be, you don't want to be stuck in this messy middle ground where you're trying to, you know, ride two horses with one ass. But at the same time, you know, if you can make low hanging improvements, kind of why would you cede that market share?
But it's also a trade off as well, right? Because Solana, like, their focus is on performance. And as a result, they're going to have less client diversity. Because even with Firedancer, if they agree that performance is their main focus, all of the clients will switch to Firedancer. No one's going to use the old Solana Labs client, because the network is only as good as your worst client. And every individual validator is going to want to have the highest performance. And as a result, you have no client diversity. Whereas Ethereum, in theory, is focused on more decentralization, robustness, and as a result, focuses on client diversity and maybe, you know, takes away a little bit from performance, but as a result, makes themselves more robust in general. So I think it's a trade-off overall.
All right. Well, this is going to get into the second topic that we're going to discuss here anyway, but do you think that more clients, like a higher amount of client diversity, is more robust? And if so, do you think you max out a certain amount? And the argument here being, like, so client diversity is something that's been argued about. Again, we're probably talking about the two oldest, longest standing arguments within like all of crypto and protocol design. But, you know, if you look at Bitcoin has one major client, which is Core. And the argument there, actually, and what maybe Adam Back would say if you were on this program, is that actually more clients does not make a protocol more robust, because what you're essentially doing is dividing attention and sets of eyeballs between two different clients, and you might actually miss like bugs or something like that. It's kind of the Stan Druckenmiller, I like to keep all of my eggs in one basket and then watch that basket extremely closely. So, and if you look at Besu, so I think I'm understanding this correctly, that so Coinbase has come up, so people have pointed out that a bunch of the validators run by Coinbase have missed slots recently, and Besu, which is I guess the way that they originally positioned themselves, is kind of an enterprise friendly Java client, but it's much less performant than the other clients that exist. And so, you know, the flip side of having multiple clients is you're only as strong as your weakest link, so to speak. And actually, by having, you know, by trying to allow, you know, creating the specs for the protocol around essentially the lowest common denominator of what a client is capable of, you're actually needlessly holding the network back. So that's the flip side. What do you guys think about the counter argument?
Yeah, I know Effort Capital on our team agrees with Adam Beck on this point, that you're actually more robust with one client because, like you said, all eyes are focused on making sure this client is robust as possible, as well as over time, if things converge to one client that is the most performant, the most secure, etc., then it's sort of found lindiness. It's sort of won, right? So I understand that argument. This is definitely out of my realm of expertise, but I know that within the Ethereum camp that they believe strongly in client diversity and that being the path to more robustness. But I could definitely see both visions here.
Yeah. What comes to my mind at first, and I don't know if this completely applies, but if you think about like free markets and competition in a market, it usually is much more beneficial to have robust competition, because then that pushes like everybody else to kind of innovate and coming up with the best product. So I kind of flip the argument of only one client being good because everybody is looking at it. Because if you have a lot of clients that are getting built, there will be like different approaches to these things, and then you might find something good at this client and then something that works better at this other client, and maybe that's going to then kind of move forward like the, I don't know, whole industry or clients as a whole.
The middle ground in between what we're talking about here, just to even maybe get a little bit more granular, is there are three basic market structures that exist: winner take all, fragmented, and then an oligopoly market structure that sits in the middle. And maybe the best, the optimal end state for clients is not I pure winner take all one client or many different clients, but like two. Like, could it be two? I mean, does that create enough competition? Maybe. I have no idea, but it seems like that actually might be. And that's like roughly where it's sort of shaken out for Ethereum as well. There are a ton of different clients. But
why I was saying that, I'm not sure this market theory kind of applies here, because I'm not sure if you can say that clients are like straight up competing against each other. Maybe it's not the same structure here, and that's why I'm kind of being careful with what I'm saying here, but maybe I have some thoughts there.
You might be right. I'm almost venturing out of my zone of competence here. But one other question that I had for you guys on the Ethereum gas conversation is, how much do you think the performance of Ethereum main chain actually impacts long run the performance of rollups? So like what I'm kind of saying is, there's rollups are going to have to pay some amount of tax down to Ethereum, be that today it's data availability and settlement. Now I expect Validiums to get much more popular in this coming market cycle, and okay, they're outsourcing DA, and you can make a pretty solid argument, I think, right off the bat, if cost was a little bit more reasonable, then maybe more rollup teams would opt to be pure play rollups, as Dankrat has reminded us, instead of Validiums, right? So that's like an example of how, if again, gas costs and compute was priced a little bit more reasonably in ETH, then maybe we'd have that. But either way, there's always going to be some amount that gets paid down to Ethereum. And let's just be really bullish here and say there are going to be thousands of rollups in the future, or a couple of rollups that are enormous, right? I guess, how much does the performance and cost of Ethereum ultimately end up impacting the end user on rollups? Like, one of the things that is starting to be in vogue again is Bitcoin, right? Rollups on Bitcoin. But the thing that they're constrained by, outside of a community which doesn't really want them, is the performance of Bitcoin, the base layer, right? There's a totally different architecture and like 10-minute block times and extremely small blocks that just makes it wildly difficult. So right now Ethereum looks kind of performant, but you've got new age competitors like Celestia coming up, and you know, if you don't try to keep the base layer performant at all, then who's to say some of these new L1s, because they're clearly going to be new L1s, you know, what's to stop them from eating Ethereum's lunch, so to speak?
Yeah, I actually do think that's a really good point, and probably a point towards raising the gas limit, in that, like you said, there are a lot of DA layers that are a lot cheaper than Ethereum's going to be under proto-dank sharding and even under dank sharding. And as a result, you're probably going to see a lot of, like you said, Validiums or Celestiums, as they're calling them, pop up, where they're using some sort of external DA layer but still settle into Ethereum. And with that, Ethereum probably needs to focus a little bit on creating the best settlement layer, and with that means more liquidity and at least enough performance to basically facilitate better liquidity and trading, etc. Because if they don't focus on that, then suddenly you could have a more performant L1 gain a bunch of liquidity, and people just use that as a settlement layer or create a trust minimized bridge to that L1. So I definitely think it's a great point, and is one further reason why increasing the gas limit may be a good idea.
Yeah, and this kind of comes down to one thing I've been thinking about a lot lately, is that, okay, if Ethereum at the end of the day just becomes a settlement layer, like, what's the value capture at that point of the layer? Like, yes, it's super important for the layers that are below it, but for the token itself, like, how do you then justify where it's valued, and like how close to moneyness it is, or whatever you want to call it?
This was originally one of my problems when Bitcoin people started saying it, was that this is going to be the ultimate settlement layer for every asset on the planet and yada yada. Like, so I just don't really believe that. But what I also don't believe is that I just don't really understand why that would accrue an enormous amount of value to you. And there's plenty of examples where, like if you look at stable coins, where do they mostly settle down to? Not to Bitcoin, to freaking Tron, because it's cost efficient. And one of the things that it's been kind of frustrating to me, you know, if you talk to people about why fees are what they are, it's like, well, we have to price compute resources. I get that you have to price compute resources, but why don't we approach the problem from how can we improve, like how can we optimize those costs instead of just like accepting those as some sort of static thing? And maybe that's a really stupid perspective, but I feel like we should be focusing more on how to drive that down while maintaining security. And you can actually, I'll link it in the show notes, but there's a really great exchange in between Peter. I'm going to blank on his last name. Silagi and Martin Kopelman. And, you know, Martin is an OG Ethereum guy, but also, you know, one of the sort of most respected kind of builders in the space, I would say. And there's a really interesting back and forth between the perspectives where Peter's clearly arguing from the standpoint, I think a lot of people at the Ethereum Foundation optimize for safety. Like they see raising the gas limit as taking on new risks. Whereas Martin is like, dude, people need to build businesses on this. Like even at 50 cents per transaction, that still prices out an enormous amount of businesses. So just interesting. You can read the back and forth though. I think it was good. All right. I've got one more update for you guys, and maybe we can use it as a jumping off point to, cause I've also had this, a long discussion about this week about whether or not rollups were going to try to use their native token as gas or whether they're going to use ETH for that. So this is a proposal that went live on Starknet back in December, but the proposal is to support fee payments and STRK and reduce transaction fees. And basically the idea is, you know, this was I think it's been a long-standing question about what is the primary currency, I suppose, or however you want to frame it, for these rollups are going to use. And you have examples of rollups using ETH. So Base is a good example of that. But there's also, I think, a lot of these rollups are going to want to use their own native tokens. And Stark, this proposal for STRK is particularly interesting because it looks like what they're going to do is enable new features for payments in STRK that would only apply to if you're paying in STRK. So that includes basically they're going to build their own native fee market, which allows users to compete for block space during congestion. So basically creating some sort of feature equivalent to 1559. There's going to be a paymaster type solution where you as an entity can sponsor users' transactions. And again, if I'm reading this correctly, it looks like that is only going to be a feature for payments in STRK. And then something called volition mode, which permits users and devs to opt out of expensive L1 DA in favor of much cheaper alternatives. So I guess like Celestia. So that's actually super interesting. I think if you just read what those things are, it's a combination of like, there's an obvious incentive for Stark where for value to accrue to Stark in some way. And something like a fee market is really central to the idea of sovereignty for these chains. So, well, what do you guys think about the idea of L2s using their own native token as sort of the primary currency for transactions?
I mean, the reason why you would use something like ETH or maybe TIA is because it simplifies the accounting, because the rollup has to pay the L1 or the DA layer in order to post their data or settle there, right? So it just helps with the accounting. If you were to use a native token, it means that you either need to create a system of swapping the native token for the underlying, or you require someone to take on some duration risk where now they're long the token and short ETH or short TIA, et cetera. And you have constant sell pressure of the token over time. So let's say
Stark is posting $10 million worth of data to Ethereum per year. Well, that's $10 million in sell pressure if they're looking to pay, if people are paying in Stark and they need to convert that to ETH. And so as a result, you basically need to think about the trade-off of, okay, I'm definitely increasing the value of my token and its utility, potentially demand, but I'm also creating a constant stream of sell pressure. And I have to deal with sort of the accounting and the potential things that could go wrong with that, such as there not being enough liquidity between the native token and ETH, et cetera. So yeah, I think it's just a trade-off. Teams are definitely going to start thinking about it. And I also think that it depends entirely as well on how cheap the data that they're posting to the L1 is, right? So if they're paying Celestia, let's say, $100,000 a year, well, yeah, they're definitely okay with having $100,000 in sell pressure for over a whole year. It's definitely worth it to increase, you know, the utility of your native token. But with something like Ethereum's current costs, it's definitely not something you'd want to do. So yeah, it's just something teams have to think about.
Yeah, I guess in these, this is me just injecting my own opinion, but outside of Arbitrum and Optimism, and even long-term Optimism and Arbitrum, I just can't see any of these rollups paying Ethereum for DA. So my like base assumption is going to be that this all gets outsourced to Celestia or EigenDA. I just can't construct a rational framework for why they would want to do that. It's just far way too much revenue. So yeah, because that's the primary reason why you wouldn't do this, is just the accounting difficulty and sell pressure. But I think like settlement to Ethereum for these rollups is pretty minimal cost. Like I think probably on the order of $50,000 to $100,000 a year, and then it's going to be roughly the same for TIA or EigenDA. So I don't know. I feel like that's sort of minimal.
Yeah, but one thing I've been thinking about is, why not kind of flip it around and have L2 users pay in the kind of the underlying tokens? So for example, in this case, ETH, and then the L2 decides on a certain profit margin for itself. And from that profit margin, it accounts or like sets aside a certain amount of ETH, which it then uses to buy the native token. So you're kind of foregoing the FX risk or the duration risk of the two assets, but still you accrue value to the underlying token of the L2.
That's an interesting idea. I guess the other reason that you might want to do it is just because it sucks from a UX. Like, not to call out, but there's a Cosmos platform that I tried to use recently, and it like kind of makes you, the default is to pay in the native token. It's like, this sucks. This is so annoying. I was annoyed by that. So yeah, I there's probably a UX reason. Brick, I think that's a good observation too. So there are probably arguments in both camps. It might end up being a dual sort of system where ETH one is default and then there's a native token too. It's an option.
Yeah, I think the best user experience would be like give the users the ability to choose what token they want to use as gas. I know Osmosis says something along these lines where you can use Atom to pay for gas. And I'm guessing they're going to add more assets once they become more liquid on Osmosis. But yeah, the more choice the user has, the better.
Agreed. Yeah.
But yeah, at the end of the day, what's important to remember is also that like the underlying token kind of has to have this moneyness component or this kind of value accrual component. So I also get why, like, even though it sucks from, for example, from a UX perspective, like at some point you just have to come up with some kind of an idea how to kind of effectively use your own native token.
Right. These tokens have to be useful for something at the end of the day. I don't know, but I still don't have a really vividly clear mental model for L2 tokens in general. I don't think these are like moneyness token things. Like, I don't think L2 staking makes an enormous amount of sense. So I don't really know what they are, to be honest. But if a bunch of the activity ends up migrating to L2s, one way to easily do that is to basically, you know, jam your token in and say, yep, it's not an ideal user experience, but still got leverage, baby. All right, guys, that feels like as good of a place to end it as any. Westy Brick, appreciate the two of you hopping on. And yeah, guys, as you can see, both these guys know more about Maker than most people will ever know. And definitely go check out the dashboard yourself. And yeah, guys, appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.